Okay, good evening everyone. Broadcasting live from the Deer Park. Today I thought I'd talk about the world, the idea of the concept of a world, loka. In Pali, we call it loka. The world is, of course, a common part of our discourse. It's something we as humans have been concerned about. Since we got stuck on this wretched rock. Even before we were attached to this earth, we still had the concept of loka. Since the beginning of time. Nowadays it's taken on a fairly specific meaning. It refers it's taken on special meaning because of what we call globalization. So whereas only a few hundred years ago world would have been confined to a fairly small area, fairly small set of things. That set of concepts and entities has increased. So we think about the world more frequently these days. We concern ourselves with wars and politics that are happening in other countries, other parts of the world. We concern ourselves with peoples, and we concern ourselves with beliefs, and we concern ourselves with a much broader set of phenomena that we, or things that we refer to as our world. And it concerns us. Some people want to change the world. This morning I was accosted, we all were accosted by the campus socialists. They had a meeting this evening that I didn't go to. I think their website is something like marx.ca or something. They're the Marxists. Marxist.ca. Telling us that now is the time for socialism. So they want to change the world. They want a revolution. Some people want to save the world. You have the social activists, the environmentalists. And then you have people who just want to get out of the world, leave behind the world, to let go of the world. Christians, I think, are big on this, maybe Muslims as well. This world is just temporary. It's like a kindergarten or a training ground for heaven. So I think especially on today, when the world is talking about itself, it's talking about specific parts of itself. This country is running away from these countries. This other country has elected a new leader, etc., etc. I think it's an appropriate topic. And fear not, it's something that Buddhism does have something to say about, advice to give to all of us. Useful advice, I think. Even more useful than at first glance. At first glance, we have this simple teaching of three worlds. There are three ways of looking at the world. And there is the akasaloka, the world of space. And then there is the sattaloka, the world of beings. And finally, there's sankhara loka, which is the world of sankharas, the world of formations. These are very different ways of looking at the world, or understanding even the concept of world. They have different applications, different results, different implications. They're actually different paradigms for ways of looking at worldviews, we might say. In religious studies, we're talking about worldviews. So these are three types of worldview. So akasaloka is the world of the physicalists. It's the world of material science, which says that the basis of reality is the material world. What you see is what you get. All that's around us is real. That there's an underlying physical reality to everything that creates the emergent phenomena, including consciousness. So this is the world of stars and solar systems. And in this world, it's a pretty bleak sort of reality. In this world, there's no saving the world. There's no leaving the world. All we have is dust. All we are is dust in the wind. We are all stardust. This is another way of looking at it. This is a more positive way. But dust nonetheless. And to dust we will return. And so it gets problematic in regards to morality. This sort of view makes it hard to find any good reason to be a good person. Sure, you can find reasons, but they generally have little to do with the material world. In the time of the Buddha, there was a teacher. This isn't a new thing. There's a teacher who said, look, if you kill someone, you're not actually killing anyone. If you take a sword and cleave someone into two pieces, cleave someone down the head, down the middle from their head, cutting them in half. I mean, the sword hasn't done anything. The sword's just gone between the atoms. It's broken the individual into two pieces. Nothing has been cut, nothing has been killed. It's a sort of a simple way of saying that, you know, all we are is impersonal particles. Death, what does death mean, right? Death is the breakup of the organism, but the parts, the particles, They don't die. It's a process of entropy. And then when the mind dies, that's it, right? The mind is emergent. It arises out of a certain yet poorly understood formation of material particles, but when they form in a certain way, somehow they create consciousness. And so that's it. When you die, that's it. Yet another reason for morality gone down the tubes, right? Why should you be moral when it doesn't really mean anything in the end? I mean, hey, why not? You could be moral, but it's not a very good reason. Seems the best way, the best thing to do would be to, well, some would argue that the best thing to do would be to cheat everyone else, right? I don't suppose a very good argument, because it still kind of hurts. It's painful to be a bad person. It's not a pleasant experience, even in this life. So it does work. And it's supremely practical in terms of delivering us nuclear power, nuclear bombs, space travel, iPads, iPods, iPhones. There's a real magic and an intoxicating magic to the material, but it's not that of that much interest to Buddhists, because it doesn't describe problems. It doesn't describe suffering, right? There's no suffering in the material world. Suffering is what? Maybe an emergent phenomenon along with the mind. You have suffering? Well, let's fix the physical. Give you some pills. Anesthetize you. Drink alcohol. A friend of mine was drinking alcohol this morning. Unfortunate. By a friend, I mean it's a fellow student at university. I'm not trying to be judgmental, but I'm not being judgmental, but it's the ways we try to fix our problems, no? It's just drown them. That's unfortunate. So, but that's not that interesting to us. What's more interesting is, well, the other two are both interesting. The second one is sattaloka, people, beings. Beings are of interest to us. Here we're dealing with problems. This is the world that most of us live in. You know, we might subscribe to the materialist or the physicalist view that we're all just particles. But nonetheless, almost all of us act as though, and almost all the time, almost all of us act as though we really exist as beings, right? We have partialities, we have likes and dislikes, we have idiosyncrasies, we have personalities, we have problems, we have suffering. This is the world that we live in, most of us, most of the time. And so we do our best to be good people, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. We try to cultivate good thoughts and good speech, help others. Or maybe we don't. Maybe we try to hurt others. Maybe we try to cheat others. But we deal with people. So we think of this as the world. We elect politicians and we employ, well, we employ others, we pay them, we exchange goods and services. We have religious leaders, we bow down to priests and monks and revere them, worship them sometimes. Many relationships, we have social relationships, friends and lovers. Children, parents, brothers, sisters. We get married. We adopt. We love, we hate. We hurt, we help. is all with beings and the world of beings. And for the most part, this is where religion rests, right? This is, and remember, by religion, I think we're, I'm already adopting my version of religion. So take what we take seriously. We take people quite seriously. So we have problems. When people have problems, we try to help them be free from their problems. Or maybe we cause problems for people. We have conflicts and attachments to others. But religion deals in people. Many religions are about saving the soul. There are religions that concern themselves very much with saving as many souls as possible, so that the soul can go to heaven, the being can go to heaven. Being doesn't have to go to hell. Hinduism, even Buddhism to some extent, you know, folk Buddhism certainly deals with beings. We all want to go to heaven, we don't want to go to hell. That's a Buddhist thing as well. Folk Buddhist, I mean, it's not deep Buddhist. But most religion deals with this. Most of what we take seriously are our relationships with others, our fate as a being, you know, our fate as a as an individual, our problems. But there's yet another limit, because a being is another atomic thing. It's an entity, and it comes into problem because it actually yet doesn't well encompass reality. I mean, this is why materialism is, or physicalism is so popular with scientists, because they realize that the being is actually made up of smaller particles, and the change in those smaller particles influences the being. So when you talk about a person and their problems, it's not that useful. You can't remove the problem like you would remove an organ. But if you delve deeper, you can see that the problem is made up of constituent parts, discrete, distinct parts. And so you can have the idea of solving problems, fixing things, creating things, both physically and mentally, by breaking it down into pieces. And so materialism or physicalism does that in one direction. It breaks everything down to the physical. So I guess the third world, you could say, Sankhara Loka, breaks it down into the mental. The physical is yet is rather dependent on the mental, rather than the other way around. And this is preferable to, I think, the argument is that this is preferable to the other worlds as far as bettering the world, making the world a better place. This is the Buddhist paradigm, I think, and on a deep level. If you look at what the Buddha taught, it seems quite clear that this is the one he favored as most useful. It's useful to think of beings. It's useful to think of physical space. These are practical. It can help you. You can build all sorts of magical things by focusing on the physical. You can create meaningful relationships if you focus on beings. You can bring, to some extent, peace on earth by dealing with beings. But there are many problems that you can't fix. There are the underlying problems. And these are the problems with the mind. So the Sankhara Loka deals with the experience of reality, deals with the world as an experience, as a canvas, as a landscape of experience. reality is our experiences. You feel pain, that's an experience. You think thoughts, that's an experience. You see lights, you hear sounds. You feel angry, you feel scared, you feel depressed. These are experiences. And so it's not that we're saying this is the right, this is the true reality. Not exactly. We don't have to go that far. But what we can say is it's a unique way of looking at the world, that it's the way that helps you work out problems in a unique, in a sort of a an ultimate, on an ultimate level, based on what's really going on. So a material scientist would argue, well, it's all based on the brain, and we don't really have to dispute that, though we might. What we can dispute is the efficacy of attacking the problem from the point of view of the physical, when it quite simply, our problems, what we call problems, are quite simply derived from our habits. And we clearly have the ability to cultivate good and bad habits. Our minds are not something you can just switch on or off. We switch off this part, switch on that part. We cultivate these habits. You can mess with the brain and you can change aspects of the mind. It doesn't appear to be ultimately fruitful. Any medication you might take merely dampens the symptoms of the problem, etc. It appears to be something beyond chemical. And well, it should, because it's a habit. So with Sankara Loka, we look at our habits, we look at the nature of our minds as we cultivate cause and effect. We engage in repeated activities that become ingrained in our minds. And through meditation we see how the mind builds up habits. As we're powerless to stop them, we're able to watch our minds going down the same pathways, cultivating the same mind states, the same patterns of behavior, the same habits again and again. And so meditation is the cultivation, it itself is the cultivation of a habit. It's a sort of a correcting, if you will, of our bad habits. So the bad habits of liking things and disliking things that wind up, you know, landing us in great stress and difficulty, we correct that with experiencing things as they are. I mean, it's not good, it's not bad, it is what it is. That's true. We consider it a correction. I mean, it might sound, I suppose, a bit cold. We consider it better, more peaceful, more conducive to happiness. We just experience things as they are, free from likes and dislikes. And this means we're not trying to tinker or tamper with our habits. Even the bad ones, even the ones that cause us suffering. We're trying to build a new habit of seeing things as they are, even the bad stuff. And eventually that habit begins to take hold, and we do begin to see things as they are, the good and the bad. And really that's all it takes. As the Buddha said, ignorance is what leads to suffering ultimately. So this is the world that we focus on. This is the world that we consider most important in terms of saving the world. So on a day like today, when there are questions and there is, you know, ultimately tension when we think about and look at the world on a global level, what's going on in the countries, this country and that country. When we find ourselves concerned, as a lot of people have been over the past year in the world, what's happening with the world, climate change, the political situation here and there and everywhere, the economic situation, trade deals and so on, are concerned very much with the world of beings and the material world. I think we'd probably do far better, or we should, at the very least, we should be careful not to forget, which I think is what I think is the more important world. It's the world that where we can make the greatest impact. No, we don't realize the impact of the cultivation of the mind. I think it's too ephemeral and too ethereal and too slow, right? It requires patience. One problem I think we have is we want to see results, physical and tangible and immediate results. We bring this to meditation as well, the desire for results. Is it working? We keep asking ourselves. But meditation isn't something that just snaps. It's a mental development in general. Again, it deals with habits. So you have to change your habit, change the way you are on a deep, fundamental level. And it's hard to see that change, and it's hard to see that change in others and the world around you. And so we focus on the physical, but physical can be quite disturbing and disappointing and frustrating, because it's not really in our control. You can't fix the world. We try to fix the climate, we try to stop ourselves from destroying the physical world. We try to influence other beings, politics and economy and religion, religious violence, right? I had an interesting conversation today with the socialists. So they gave me this pamphlet, I walked away, and on my way back I stopped to talk to them, and they said, "Do you have any questions?" And I said, "What do you think of meditation?" And I sort of explained myself. I said, I've talked to socialists, and I used to be involved with them many years ago, but they don't seem very nice, I said. And he said, "Well, yes, I know some can be." And I said, "So I said, the reason I'm saying that is not, I don't have anything particularly against socialists, but they seem to be focused much more on the external. When, these are my questions, how do you make people nicer? You want to have people be nice to each other. How do you make people nicer?" And he said something interesting. He said, "Well, it's hard to be nice when you're just concerned about the next meal. When you don't know, when you don't have a job, when you're living below the poverty line, trying to feed your kids, etc., etc. It's hard to be nice." And so he thinks nice has to come from a nice society. And I think he's right. I think there's something to that. I don't think it's enough. But he admitted that, we have to go internal as well. He didn't think that was enough. And I would agree with that. You do have to have what we call sapaya. You need to have a good place to practice and a good place to build your own. You have to live in a good world. A harsh world becomes more difficult to meditate, difficult to train, difficult to become a better person in. So it is something to concern ourselves with. It's not to say that any of these worlds is meaningless. Let's say they work together. But I think it's arguable that the most important one, simply because we have the most immediate, we can have the most immediate and lasting effect on it, is the Sankhara Loka. Because if you change that, it's the source of the others. When you act with other beings, if your mind is not pure, you can't really do much good. If you act in the material world trying to save the planet, it's like digging in sand. Unless we change people's craving and greed for consumption, it'll never be enough. We'll never have enough. We'll always be stealing from each other, hoarding from each other, manipulating and benefiting at the expense of each other. So that's what we focus on as Buddhists. We'll let the socialists focus on changing the world, and we'll let the material scientists focus on the climate and so on. And maybe if we work together, we can do good. There's still good in this world. Anyone who ever looks at the news and worries about the state of affairs, the state of the world, and gets depressed and loses hope and thinks this world is just a terrible place full of terrible people, I think they should turn off the news and look inside and look around. There are good people in this world, and in all people there are still good things. There's even in the generally bad people, you know, we can still find good. And so, not that we have to make everyone out to be good, but even the Buddha said, you don't want to hate someone else. Too much hate in this world, and there's too much hate lately in politics, in religion, in economics. Too much hate. The rich hate the poor hate the rich, the Democrats hate the Republicans hate the Democrats. Everybody hates our leaders. The Muslims hate the Jews hate the Muslims. Not the, but some Jews hate some Muslims hate some Jews. And so we shouldn't despair. We shouldn't fall into hate, is what I was going to say. There's too much hate, and I even see it with good people. Not so much with Buddhists. We're pretty good at avoiding that and coming to good thoughts, even in regards to the events of today. But we shouldn't despair, and we shouldn't fall into judgments and hates and so on. There's no need, there's no good that comes from it. I think this teaching of the three worlds gives us a good framework within which to work. And so I suppose it could even be said that a person living in the world should consider all three of these worlds when they try to fix things, when they try to save the world, when they try to better the world. When they even just approach the world, you have to consider all three. The material world, so your house, you know. Nowadays we live in houses, you have to make sure your house isn't on fire. And metaphorically speaking as well. Our house, the earth is our house, our country is our house, our society, our neighborhood, our schools and our workplaces, these are our houses, and we want to make sure they don't burn down. We want to take care of them. And so that relates to Sattaloka beings. Our houses, our communities, our relationships, our families. I don't want them to burn down. I don't want our house to burn down. And in Sankara Loka, we don't want our house to burn down. We don't want our world to collapse. We want our world to become a better place. And that goes for experience as well. We wish to be happy. We wish for peace. And so we can work on all three of these levels for that. I think that's how we should approach the concept of the world affairs. So there you go, that's the Dhamma for tonight. Now I'll wait for the meditators to leave and we can talk about questions you might have. So the interesting thing here is that the two meditators who are listening are from America, and they both arrived yesterday, and neither one of them knows the results of the election yesterday. One of them is Robin. I think many of you know Robin, who is actually quite political. But I don't think she would had a horse in the race. She wasn't for either candidate. Still, I certainly didn't want to spoil it for them, because I assume that would disturb their meditation. Anyway, I think that's a useful talk for them, so that when they do leave, they'll have something to consider. I'm going to have to prepare them for it. But prepare all of us, no? This is something we have to think about. The world events, everyone at the university is talking about the election in America. And so people in peace studies are considering what it means and how we can work with this in the future. And so I think it's important, as Buddhists, we don't get too sidetracked and we don't become discouraged by world events, because the world is inside of us. Okay. So some questions. Where one draws the line between silently observing things happening and taking action to change things? Well, I think for the most part, changing things comes as a result of the way you look at the world, right? If you are an angry person and the way you look at the world is everything's bad, that's going to have a significant impact on the way you behave. Right? What you do in the world. If you're a sort of positive person who thinks always about the positive, then that will influence your behavior in the world as well. If you're mindful and objective, then everything you do, we would say, would be touched by wisdom and understanding. clarity. And so you wouldn't so much rush out to save the world as you would interact peacefully and harmoniously, cultivating peace and harmony wherever you went, simply as a result of your peaceful outlook. It's a natural expression of your mind. Sankara and Sankara Loka refers to I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure it refers to the five aggregates, or the Abhidhamma, you might say, the world of formations. It's not just the world of karma. I don't think that's what it's saying. It means sabbe sankhara anicca. That's what it's referring to. That which arises and ceases. It's the experiential reality. Sadness. Sadness is kamma. Sadness is dosa. It's an akusala. Akusala mula citta. You have to remember that kamma and vipaka are actually, they're just technical. Like the citta are, they are distinguished, but it's just a technical distinction. So vipaka is the feeling. Well, vipaka is seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, or thinking. It's an experience that results. It's the experience. But sadness is a reaction. So sadness is a kamma. It's part of the javana. Or it's, you know, I mean, it's made up of many different things. Sadness is also physical. There's the physical chemicals involved with sadness and so on. There's the tears and the scrunching up of the face and the tension. But the what we call sadness, the kernel of it is mental, and it is anger, it's a disliking. Of course, it's usually followed by euphoria, because there's a drugging effect, the release of I don't know, is it oxytocin, endorphins? I don't know what's released when you cry, but it makes you feel good. So crying has a sort of a bittersweet quality to it. It's interesting how crying can actually be quite pleasing, pacifying. This is why we say let it all out, because when you cry you feel better. So there's many different aspects, but you have to understand that at the core, the moment when we're actually sad is anger. It's just because it's got all this flavoring to it that we call it sadness. Need, desire for Nibbana hinders achieving it. Often can. It's probably mixed, because in there is probably some wisdom for the most part. I mean, most ordinary people wouldn't ever think to desire or crave nirvana, nibbana. But yes, it's possible to be misled and just get the idea that it's going to end all my problems, right? The funny thing is, nibbana is realizing, is to get to nibbana, you have to realize you don't have any problems and there's no you in the first place, so no, nirvana doesn't end all your problems. So if you have that idea, it's like you're approaching it from the wrong point of view. It's something like trying to bring all your possessions along with you when you die. Being buried with all your treasures, thinking that you'll get them in heaven. It's that kind of thing. It's analogous to that, because you can't bring yourself to Nibbana. So if you're thinking that Nibbana is going to solve all your problems, you're never going to get there. But there's usually involved some kind of wisdom in our stressful clinging of wishing, expecting, hoping for Nibbana. There's usually some wisdom involved. So what that means is, we tend to keep going, even though we are stressed because of our craving and our desire and our clinging to it. We tend to continue striving to attain it. So it's mixed. There's some good in that, right? But the good doesn't come from the clinging. The good comes from the kind of general understanding that it's good. You have to be careful, because if you said need desire for Nibbana is bad, then often just saying that, whether it's technically true or not, just saying that would lead people to complacency. So they wouldn't pay attention to this thought that Nibbana is good. They would say, yeah, well, I don't want to cling, so I won't strive, right? When you should strive. You should strive not out of clinging, but out of wisdom. You should listen to that thought, that it would be good to purify your mind. Because too often we don't listen to that thought. We realize, yes, it would be good to clean, good to purify my mind, but maybe later. There's no hurry, right? And so we don't strive. Joy, happiness. Joy and happiness are vedana. So they don't actually technically qualify as either kamma or vipaka, because they're associated with citta. The citta is the vipaka. Why I can say sadness is karmic is because any mind that has sadness in it is karmically negative, is a akusala kamma. But it's not the same with vedana. So there can be, let me see. There can be vipaka that has happiness, and there can be kamma that has happiness. And the kamma can be both wholesome or unwholesome. So happiness and joy is getting a little bit weird, but it's still mostly understood as happiness. So happiness or joy generally is highly universal, indeterminate. So it can be wholesome, it can be unwholesome, and it can be resultant. But the resultant would be wholesome. It would only be the result of a wholesome mind. But greed is often associated with happiness. Sukha. Somanasa sahagatang. But wholesome deeds are also often associated with happiness. So they're also somanasa sahagatang. But you can't say that joy or happiness are kamma, because they're just ajetasika vedana. They're vedana that comes with certain minds, both wholesome, unwholesome, and resultant. Sadness, on the other hand, domanasa. Domanasa is always unwholesome. And it only comes in a kamma, akusala kamma. It's the experience of joy without any reason that arises in meditation, illusion. I find myself clinging to it, trying to absorb in it. Well, it's not illusion, but you have to understand what you're talking about. When, you know, illusion and reality, it's real. But just because something's real doesn't mean that there's deeper meaning to it. When you say illusion, you're implying, I think, that something real would mean meaningful. But real doesn't mean meaningful. So you're asking, is it real happiness or is it illusory happiness? I mean, it really is what it is. So it's real. But it doesn't have any meaning to it. And indeed, it's ephemeral. So it's problematic. It's flawed, even though it's real. So you might say it's not real happiness. We would often say that. But what we mean by that is it's not really going to make you happy. You know, clinging to it, expecting it, having some kind of expectation or relying on it. It's not going to bring good things. So when you cling to it, when you cling to anything, that's the problem. The happiness isn't problematic. The clinging to it is. Happiness comes and goes. It's really inconsequential, meaningless. And it's truly meaningless because your happiness doesn't, true happiness doesn't depend on it, doesn't have anything to do with it. True peace, true goodness, true contentment doesn't have to do with the happiness and joy that you feel. That's just ephemeral stuff that comes and goes. What is this person doing? Are you trying to stand on me? Excuse me, sir. Please desist or I will be forced to eject you. Looks like they're just learning to walk. All right, well, I'm going to head out then. Have a good night, everyone. I think I'll post this talk on Facebook. There's too much politics and such on Facebook. Let's add our drop to the bucket, no? Okay, good night, everyone.